But perhaps she can also teach you the rudiments of combat with it.
Did someone speak of me?
The young woman I had met at the front of the shop now came from one of the dark storerooms at its rear. With her upturned nose and strangely tilted eyes, she looked so much like her brother, I felt sure they were twins. But the slender figure and the delicate features that seemed incongruent in him were compelling in her. Her brother must have explained what had befallen me. I do not know because I did not hear it. I was looking only at her. Now I begin again. It has been a long time. Twice I have heard the guard changed outside my study door. Since I wrote the lines you read only a moment before. I am not certain it is right to record these scenes, which perhaps are important only to me, in so much detail. I might easily have condensed everything. I saw a shop and went in. I was challenged by an officer of the Septentrions. The shopkeeper sent his sister to help me pluck the poisoned flower. I have spent weary days in reading the histories of my predecessors, and they consist of little but such accounts. For example, of Imar. Disguising himself, he ventured into the countryside, where he spied a Muni meditating beneath a plane tree. The autarch joined him and sat with his back to the trunk until earth had begun to spurn the sun. Troopers bearing an oriflamme galloped past. A merchant drove a mule staggering under gold. A beautiful woman rode the shoulders of eunuchs, and at last, a dog trotted through the dust. Imar rose and followed the dog, laughing. Supposing this anecdote to be true, how easy it is to explain. The autarch had demonstrated that he chose his active life by an act of will and not because of the seductions of the world. But Thekla had had many teachers, each of whom would explain the same fact in a different way. Here then a second teacher might say that the autarch was proof against those things that attract common men, but powerless to control his love of the hunt. And a third, that the autarch wished to show his contempt for the Muni, who had remained silent when he might have poured forth enlightenment and received more, that he could not do by leaving when there was none to share the road, since solitude has great attractions for the wise. Nor could he when the soldiers passed, nor the merchant with his wealth, nor the woman, for unenlightened men desire all those things, and the Muni would have thought him one more such man. And a fourth, that the autarch accompanied the dog because it went forth alone, the soldiers having other soldiers, the merchant his mule, and the mule his merchant, and the woman her slaves, while the Muni did not go forth. Yet, why did Imar laugh? Who shall say? Did the merchant follow the soldiers to buy their booty? Did the woman follow the merchant to sell her kisses and her loins? Was the dog of the hunting kind? Or such a short-limbed one as women keep to bark, lest someone fondle them while they sleep? Who now shall say? Imar is dead, and such memories of his, as lived for a time in the blood of his successors, are long faded. So mine in time shall fade too. Of this I feel sure. Not one of the explanations for the behavior of Imar was correct. The truth, whatever it may have been, was simpler and more subtle. Of me it might be asked why I accepted the shopkeeper's sister as my companion. I, who in all my life had had no true companion, and who, reading only of the shopkeeper's sister, would understand why I remained with her after what is, at this point in my own story, about to happen. No one, surely.
I have said that I cannot explain my desire for her, and it is true. I loved her with a love thirsty and desperate. I felt that we two might commit some act so atrocious that the world, seeing us, would find it irresistible. No intellect is needed to see those figures who wait beyond the void of death. Every child is aware of them, blazing with glories, dark or bright, wrapped in authority older than the universe. They are the stuff of our earliest dreams, as of our dying visions. Rightly we feel our lives guided by them, and rightly, too, we feel how little we matter to them. The builders of the unimaginable, the fighters of wars beyond the totality of existence. The difficulty lies in learning that we ourselves encompass forces equally great. We say, I will and I will not, and imagine ourselves, though we obey the orders of some prosaic person every day, our own masters, when the truth is that our masters are sleeping. One wakes within us, and we are ridden like beasts, though the rider is but some hitherto unguessed part of ourselves. Perhaps, indeed, that is the explanation of the story of Ymir. Who can say? However that may be, I let the shopkeeper's sister help me adjust the mantle. It could be drawn tightly about the neck, and when it was worn so, my Fuligian guild cloak was invisible beneath it. Still, without revealing myself, I could reach through the front or through slits at the sides. I unfastened Terminus Est from her baldric and carried her like a staff for as long as I wore that mantle. And because her sheath covered most of her guard and was tipped with dark iron, many of the people who saw me no doubt thought it was one. It was the only time in my life when I have covered the habit of the guild with a disguise. I have heard it said that one always feels a fool in them, whether they succeed or not, and surely I felt a fool in that one. And yet it was hardly a disguise at all. Those wide, old-fashioned mantles originated with shepherds who wear them still, and were passed from them to the military in the days when the fighting with the Ascians took place here in the cool south. From the army they were taken up by religious pilgrims, who no doubt found a garment that could be converted into a more or less satisfactory little tent very practical. The decline of religion has no doubt done much to extinguish them in Nessus, where I never saw any other than the one I wore myself. If I had known more about them when I put on mine in the rag shop, I would have bought a soft, wide-brimmed hat to go with it. But I did not, and the shopkeeper's sister told me I looked a good palmer. No doubt she said it with that twinkle of mockery with which she said everything else. But I was concerned with my appearance and failed to notice it. I told her and her brother that I wished I knew more of religion. Both smiled, and the brother said, "If you mention it first, no one will want to talk about it. Besides, you can get the reputation of being a good fellow by wearing that and not talking about it. When you meet someone you don't want to talk to at all, beg alms." So I became, in appearance at least, a pilgrim bound for some vague northern shrine. Have I said that time turns our lies into truths?
Audible Frontiers presents The Shadow of the Torturer, written by Gene Wolfe and narrated by Jonathan Davis.
Chapter 18. The Destruction of the Altar. The hush of early morning had vanished while I was in the rag shop. Wains and drays rumbled by in an avalanche of beasts, wood and iron. The shopkeeper's sister and I had no more than stepped out of the door than I heard a flyer skimming among the towers of the city. I looked up in time to see it, sleek as a raindrop on a windowpane. "That's probably the officer who called you out," she remarked. "He'll be on his way back to the House Absolute." "A hipparch of the Septentrion Guard, isn't that what Agilis said?"
"Is that your brother?"
"Yes, something like that."
"What is your own name?"
"Agia. And you know nothing of Monomachy, and have me for an instructor.
Well, hi, Hippogian, help you.
We'll have to go to the Botanic Gardens to begin with and cut you an avern. Fortunately, they're not too far from here. Do you have enough money for us to take a fiacre?"
"I suppose so, if it is necessary."
"Then you're really not an armiger in costume. You're a whatever you are."
"A torturer, yes. When am I supposed to meet the Hipparch?"
"Not until late afternoon, when the fighting begins at the Sanguinary Field and the Avern opens its flower. We've plenty of time, but I think we'd better use it in getting you one and teaching you how to fight with it."
A fiacre drawn by a pair of onagers was dodging toward us, and she waved to it.
"You're going to be killed, you know."
"From what you say, it seems very likely."
"It's practically certain. So don't worry about your money."
Agia stepped out into the traffic, looking for a moment. So finely chiseled was that delicate face, so graceful the curve of her body as she lifted an arm, like a memorial statue to the unknown woman on foot. I thought she was certain to be killed herself. The fiacre drew up to her, with the skittish animals dancing to one side as though she were a Thiocene, and she vaulted in. Light as she was, her weight made the little vehicle rock. I climbed in beside her, where we sat with our hips pressed together. The driver glanced back at us. Agia said, "The landing for the Botanic Gardens," and we jolted off.
"So dying doesn't bother you, that's refreshing."
I braced myself with a hand on the back of the driver's bench. "Surely that's not unusual. There must be thousands and perhaps millions of people like me. People accustomed to death, who feel that the only part of their lives that really mattered is over." The sun was now just above the tallest spires, and the flooding light that turned the dusty pavement to red gold made me feel philosophical. In the brown book in my sabretache, there was the tale of an angel, perhaps actually one of the winged women warriors who were said to serve the Autarch, who, coming to Earth on some petty mission or other, was struck by a child's arrow and died. With her gleaming robes all dyed by her heart's blood, even as the boulevards were stained by the expiring life of the sun, she encountered Gabriel himself. His sword blazed in one hand, his great two-headed axe swung in the other, and across his back, suspended on the rainbow, hung the very battle horn of heaven. "Where wend you, little one?" asked Gabriel. "With your breast, more scarlet than the robin's."
"I am killed," the angel said. "And I return to merge my substance once more with the Pan-Creator."
"Do not be absurd. You are an angel, a pure spirit, and cannot die."
"But I am dead," said the angel. "Nevertheless,
you have observed the wasting of my blood. Do you not observe also that it no longer issues in straining spurtings, but only seeps sluggishly? Note the pallor of my countenance. Is not the touch of an angel warm and bright? Take my hand, and you will imagine you hold a horror new dragged from some stagnant pool. Taste my breath. Is it not fetid, foul, and nidorous?" Gabriel answered nothing, and at last the angel said,
"Brother and better,
even if I have not convinced you with all my proofs, I pray you stand aside. I would rid the universe of my presence.
I am convinced indeed. Gabriel said, stepping from the other's way. It is only that I was thinking that had I known we might perish, I would not at all times have been so bold. To Agia I said, I feel like the archangel in the story. If I had known I could spend my life so easily and so soon, I would not probably have done it. Do you know the legend? But I have made my decisions now, and there's nothing more to say or do. This afternoon the Septentrion will kill me with what? A plant? A flower? In some way I don't understand. A short time ago I thought I could go to a place called Thrax and live there whatever life there was to be lived. Well, last night I roomed with a giant. One is not more fantastical than the other. She did not reply, and after a time I asked, What is that building over there? The one with the vermilion roof and the forked columns. I think there's allspice pounded in the mortar. At least I smell something of that sort from it. The mensal of the monarchs. Do you know you are a frightening man? When you entered our shop, I thought you only another young armiger in motley. Then, when I found you really were a torturer, I thought it couldn't really be so bad after all that you were only a young man like other young men. And you have known a great many young men, I imagine. The truth was that I was hoping she had. I wanted her to be more experienced than I. And though I did not for an instant think myself pure, I wished to think her less pure still. But there is something more to you after all. You have the face of someone who stands to inherit 2 Palatinates and an isle somewhere I never heard of, and the manners of a shoemaker. And when you say you're not afraid to die, you think you mean it, and under that you believe you don't. But you do, at the very bottom. It wouldn't bother you a bit to chop off my head either, would it? Around us swirled traffic of every sort, machines, wheeled and wheelless vehicles pulled by animals and slaves, walkers and riders on the backs of dromedaries, oxen, metamynodons, and hackneys. Now an open fiacre like our own drew up beside us. Agia leaned toward the couple it carried and shouted, "We'll distance you!"
"We're bound,"
the man called back, and I recognized Sior Racho, whom I had once met when I had been sent to Master Ultan for books. I gripped Agia by the arm. "Are you mad or is he?"
"The garden landing for Akrisos!"
The other vehicle tore away with ours behind it.
"Faster!"
Agia shouted to our driver. Then to me,
"Have you a dagger? It's best to put the point to his back, so he can say he drove under threat of annihilation if we're stopped."
"Why are you doing this?"
"As a test. No one will believe your disguise.
But everyone will believe you're an armiger in fancy dress."
"I've just proved it."
We careened about a dray loaded with sand.
"Besides, we'll win.
I know this driver and his team's fresh. The other's been carting that whore for half the night." I realized then that I would be expected to give Agia the money if we won, and that the other woman would claim my non-existent Krisos from Racho if they did.
Yet how sweet to humble him.
Speed and the nearness of death, for I felt certain I would indeed be slain by the Hipparch, made me more reckless than I had ever been in my life. I drew Terminus Est, and thanks to the length of her blade, I could reach the onagers easily. Their flanks were already soaked with sweat, and the shallow cuts I made there must have burned like flames.
"That's better than any dagger," I told Agia.
The crowd parted like water before the driver's whips. Mothers clasping their children as they fled, soldiers vaulting on their spears to the safety of windowsills. The conditions of the race favored us. The fiacre ahead, to some extent, cleared our path, and it was more impeded by other vehicles than we. Still, we gained only slowly, and to get a few ells advantage, our driver, who no doubt anticipated a rich tip if he won, sent the onagers hurtling up a flight of broad, chalcedony steps. Marbles and monuments, pillars and pilasters seemed thrown at our faces. We crashed through the green wall of a hedge, as high as a house, overturned a cartload of comfits, dove through an arch and down a stair wound in a half-turn, and were in the street again, without ever knowing whose patio we had violated. A baker's barrow drawn by sheep ambled into the narrow space between our vehicle and the other, and our big rear wheel jolted it, sending a shower of fresh bread into the street and throwing Agia's slight body against mine so pleasantly that I put an arm about it and held it there. I had clasped women so before, Thecla often, and hired bodies in the town. There was new bittersweetness in this, born of the cruel attraction Agia held for me.
"I'm glad you did that," she said in my ear. "I hate men who grab me," and covered my face with kisses.
The driver looked back with a grin of triumph, letting the maddened team choose its own path.
"Gone down the twisted way! Got them now! Across the common and reached them by 100 ells!
The fiacre reeled and plunged into a narrow gateway in a barrier of shrubbery. An immense building loomed before us. The driver tried to turn his animals, but it was too late. We hit its side. It gave like the fabric of a dream, and we were in a cavernous space, dimly lit and smelling of hay. Ahead was a stepped altar as large as a cottage and dotted with blue lights. I saw it and realized I was seeing it too well. Our driver had been swept out of his seat or had jumped clear. Agia shrieked. We crashed into the altar. There was a confusion of flying objects impossible to describe, the sense of everything whirling and tumbling and never colliding as in the chaos before creation. The ground seemed to leap at me. It struck with an impact that set my ears humming. I had been holding Terminus Est, I think, while I flew through the air, but she was no longer in my hand. When I tried to get up to look for her, I had no breath and no strength. Somewhere far off, a man shouted. I rolled on my side, then managed to get my lifeless legs beneath me. We seemed to be near the center of the building, which was as big around as the Great Keep and yet completely empty, without interior walls, stairs, or furniture of any kind. Through the golden dusty air I could see crooked pillars that seemed of painted wood. Lamps, mere points of light, hung a chain or more overhead. Far above them, a many-colored roof rippled and snapped in a wind I could not feel. I stood on straw, and straw was spread everywhere in an endless yellow carpet, like the field of a titan after harvest. All about me were the battens of which the altar had been constructed, fragments of thin wood braved with gold leaf and set with turquoises and violet amethysts. With some vague idea of finding my sword, I began to walk, stumbling almost at once over the smashed body of the fiacre. One onager lay not far from it. I recall thinking it must have broken its neck. Someone called Torturer, and I looked around and saw Agia, standing erect, though shakily. I asked if she were all right.
"Alive, anyway. But we must leave this place at once. Is that animal dead?"
I nodded.
"I could have ridden on it. Now you'll have to carry me if you can. I don't think my right leg will bear my weight."
She tottered as she spoke,
and I had to spring to her and catch her to keep her from falling.
"Now we have to go," she said. "Look around. Can you see a door? Quickly."
I could not. Why is it so urgent that we leave?
"Use your nose if you can't use your eyes to see this floor,"
I sniffed. The odor in the air was no longer straw, but straw burning. At almost the same instant, I saw the flames, bright in the gloom, but still so small that a few moments before they must have been mere sparks. I tried to run, but could manage nothing better than a limping walk.
"Where are we?"
"It's the Cathedral of the Pelerines. Some call it the Cathedral of the Claw. The Pelerines are a band of priestesses who travel the continent. They never..."
Adja broke off because we were approaching a cluster of scarlet-clad people. Or perhaps they were approaching us, for they seemed to me to have appeared in the middle distance without warning. The men had shaven heads and held gleaming scimitars, curved like the young moon and blazing with gilding. A woman with the towering height of an exultant cradled a sheathed two-handed sword. My own Terminus Est. She wore a hood and a narrow cape that trailed long tassels. Adja began, "Our animals ran wild, holy Dominicale."
"That is of no moment,"
the woman who held my sword said. There was much beauty in her, but it was not the beauty of women who quench desire.
"This belongs to the man carrying you. Tell him to set you on your feet and take it. You can walk."
"A little. Do as she says, torturer."
"Don't you know his name?"
"He told me, but I've forgotten."
I said Severian, and steadied her with one hand while I accepted Terminus Est with the other.
"Use it to end quarrels,"
the woman in scarlet said, "not to begin them." "The straw floor of this great tent is on fire, Chatelaine. Do you know it?"
"It will be extinguished. The sisters and our servants are crushing the embers now."
She paused, her gaze flickering from Adja to me and back to Adja again.
"In the remains of our high altar, which your vehicle destroyed, we found only one thing that seemed yours, and likely to be of value to you, that sword. We have returned it. Will you now also return to us anything of value to us you may have found?"
I remembered the amethysts. "I found nothing of value, Chatelaine." Adja shook her head and I continued. "There were splinters of wood set with precious stones, but I left them where they had fallen." The men shifted the hilts of their weapons in their hands and sought good footing, but the tall woman stood motionless, staring at me, then at Adja, then at me once more.
"Come to me, Severian."
I came forward a matter of 3 or 4 paces. It was a great temptation to draw Terminus Est as a defense against the men's blades, but I resisted it. Their mistress took my wrists in her hands and looked into my eyes. Her own were calm, and in the strange light seemed hard as barrels.
"There is no guilt in him," she said.
One of the men muttered,
"You are mistaken, Dominicale."
"No guilt, I say. Step back, Severian, and let the woman come forward."
I did as she told me, and Adja limped to within a long pace of her. When she would not come nearer, the tall woman came to her and took her wrists as she had mine. After a moment, she glanced toward the other women who had waited behind the swordsman. Before I realized what was happening, two of them seized Adja's gown and drew it over her head and away.
One said, "Nothing, mother. I think this the day foretold."
Her hands crossed over her breasts,
Agia whispered to me.
These Pelerines are insane. Everyone knows it. And if I had had more time, I would have told you so.
The tall woman said,
Return her rags. The claw has not vanished in living memory. But it does so at will, and it would be neither possible nor permissible for us to stop it.
One of the women murmured,
We may find it in the wreckage still, Mother.
A second added,
Should they not be made to pay?
Let us kill them,
a man said. The tall woman gave no indication that she had heard any of them. She was already leaving us, seeming to glide across the straw. The women followed her, looking at one another, and the men lowered their gleaming blades and backed away. Agia was struggling into her gown. I asked her what she knew of the claw and who these Pelerines were.
Get me out of here, Severian, and I'll tell you.
It isn't lucky to talk of them in their own place. Is that a tear in the wall over there? We walked in the direction she had indicated, stumbling sometimes in the soft straw. There was no opening, but I was able to lift the edge of the silken wall, enough for us to slip under. Chapter 19 The Botanic Gardens. The sunlight was blinding. It seemed as if we had stepped from twilight into full day. Golden particles of straw swam in the crisp air about us.
That's better,
Agia said. Wait a moment now and let me get my bearings.
I think the Adamnian steps will be to our right. Our driver wouldn't have gone down them, or perhaps he would, the fellow was mad, but they should take us to the landing by the shortest route. Give me your arm again, Severian. My leg's not quite recovered.
We were walking on grass now, and I saw that the tent cathedral had been pitched on a champion surrounded by semi-fortified houses. Its insubstantial belfries looked down upon their parapets. A wide paved street bordered the open lawn, and when we reached it, I asked again who the Pelerines were. Agia looked sidelong at me.
You must forgive me, but I don't find it easy to talk of professional virgins to a man who's just seen me naked. Though under other circumstances it might be different.
She drew a deep breath.
I don't really know a great deal about them, but we have some of their habits in the shop, and I asked my brother about them once, and after that paid attention to whatever I heard. It's a popular costume for masks, all that red. Anyway, they are an order of conventionals, as no doubt you've already discerned. The red is for the descending light of the new sun, and they descend on landowners, traveling around the country with a cathedral and seizing enough to set it up. Their order claims to possess the most valuable relic in existence, the claw of the conciliator. So the red may be for the wounds of the claw as well. Trying to be facetious, I said,
I didn't know he had claws.
It isn't a real claw. It's said to be a gem. You must have heard of it. I don't understand why it's called the claw, and I doubt that those priestesses do themselves. But assuming it to have had some real association with the conciliator, you can appreciate its importance. After all, our knowledge of him now is purely historical, meaning that we either confirm or deny that he was in contact with our race in the remote past. If the claw is what the Pelerines represent it to be, then he once lived, though he may be dead now. A startled glance from a woman carrying a dulcimer told me the mantle I had bought from Agia's brother was in disarray, permitting the fuligin of my guild cloak, which must have looked like mere empty darkness to the poor woman, to be seen through the opening. As I rearranged it and reclasped the fibula, I said, like all these religious arguments,
this one gets less significant as we continue. Supposing the conciliator to have walked among us eons ago and to be dead now, of what importance is he, save to historians and fanatics? I value his legend as a part of the sacred past, but it seems to me that it is the legend that matters today, and not the conciliator's dust.
Agia rubbed her hands, seeming to warm them in the sunlight.
Supposing him... We turn at this corner, Severian. You may see the head of the stair, if you'll look. There, where the statues of the Eponym stand. Supposing him to have lived, he was by definition the master of power, which means the transcendence of reality and includes the negation of time. Isn't that correct?
I nodded.
Then there is nothing to prevent him from a position, say, of 30,000 years ago, coming into what we call the present. Dead or not, if he ever existed, he could be around the next bend of the street, or the next turn of the week.
We had reached the beginning of the stair. The steps were of stone as white as salt, sometimes so gradual that several strides were needed to go from one descent to the next, sometimes almost as abrupt as a ladder. Confectioners, sellers of apes, and the like had set up their stands here and there. For whatever reason, it was very pleasant to discuss mysteries with Agia while descending these steps. And I said, "All this because those women say they possess one of his glittering fingernails? I suppose it performs miraculous cures?"
"On occasion, so they claim.
It also forgives injuries, raises the dead, draws new races of beings from the soil, purifies lust, and so on. All the things he is supposed to have done himself." "You're laughing at me now."
"No, only laughing at the sunshine. You know what it is supposed to do to women's faces."
"Make them brown."
"Make them ugly. To begin with, it dries the skin and creates wrinkles and so on. Then, too, it shows up every little defect. Urvasi loved Pururavas, you know, before she saw him in a bright light. Anyway, I felt it on my face, and I was thinking, I don't care for you. I'm still too young to worry about you, and next year I'll get a wide hat from our stock."
Adya's face was far from perfect now in the clear sunshine, but she had nothing to fear from it.
My hunger fed at least as ravenously upon her imperfections. She possessed the hopeful, hopeless courage of the poor, which is perhaps the most appealing of all human qualities. And I rejoiced in the flaws that made her more real to me.
"Anyway," she continued, squeezing my hand, "I have to admit, I've never understood why people like the Pellerines always think ordinary people have to have their lust purified. In my experience, they control it well enough by themselves, and just about every day, too. What most of us need is to find someone we can unbottle it with."
"Then you care that I love you."
I was only half joking. "Every woman cares if she's loved. And the more men who love her, the better. But I don't choose to love you in return, if that's what you mean. It would be so easy today, going around the city with you like this. But then if you're killed this evening, I'll feel badly for a fortnight."
"So will I,"
I said. "No, you won't. You won't even care. Not about that or anything. Not ever again. Being dead doesn't hurt, as you of all people should know."
"I'm almost inclined to think this whole affair is some trick of yours, or of your brother's. You were outside when the Septentrion came. Did you tell him something to inflame him against me? Is he your lover?"
Agia laughed at that, her teeth flashing in the sun.
Look at me. I have a brocade gown, but you've seen what's beneath it.
My feet are bare. Do you see rings or earrings? A silver lamia twined about my neck? Are my arms constricted with circlets of gold? If not, you may safely assume I have no officer of the household troops for my paramour.
There's an old sailor, ugly and poor, who presses me to live with him.
Other than that, well, Agilis and I own our shop. It was bequeathed to us by our mother, and it's free of debt, only because we can find no one who's enough of a fool to lend anything on it. Sometimes we rip up something from our stock and sell it to the papermakers so we can buy a bowl of lentils to divide between us.
You should eat well tonight, anyway, I told her. I gave your brother a good price for this mantle.
What?
Her good humor seemed to have returned. She took a step back and feigned astonishment with an open mouth.
You won't buy me a supper this evening? After I've spent the day counseling you and guiding you about...
Involving me in the destruction of the altar those pelerines had erected.
I'm sorry about that. I really am. I didn't want you to tire your legs. You'll need them when you fight. Then those others came up and I thought, I saw a chance for you to make some money.
Her look had left my face and come to rest on one of the brutal busts that flanked the stair. I asked, "Is that really all there was to it?"
To confess the truth, I wanted them to go on thinking you might be an armiger. Armigers go about in fancy dress so much because they're always going to fetes and tournaments, and you have the face. That's why I thought so myself when I first saw you. And you see, if you were, then I was someone that somebody like that, an armiger and probably the bastard of an exultant, might care for. Even if it was only a kind of joke, I had no way of knowing what would happen.
I understand, I said. Suddenly laughter overcame me. What fools we must have looked, jolting along in the fiacre.
If you understand, then kiss me.
I stared at her.
Kiss me? How many chances have you left?
I'll give you more. What you want? She paused, then laughed too.
After supper, perhaps, if we can find a private spot.
Though it won't be good for your fighting. She threw herself into my arms then, rising on her toes to press my lips. Her breasts were firm and high, and I could feel the motion of her hips.
There now.
She pushed me away.
Look down there, Severian, between the pylons. What do you see?
Water glimmered like a mirror in the sun. The river.
Yes, Guile. Now to the left.
Because there are so many nenuphars, the island is hard to see, but the lawn is a lighter, brighter green.
Don't you see the glass, where it catches the light?
I see something. Is the building all glass? She nodded.
That's the Botanic Gardens, where we're going.
They'll let you cut the avern there. All you have to do is demand it as your right. We made the rest of the descent in silence. The Adamnian steps wind back and forth across a long hillside, and they are a favored place for strollers, who often hire a ride to the top and descend. I saw many couples, finely dressed, men with the marks of old difficulties scarring their faces, and romping children. Saddening me more, I saw two from several points, the dark towers of the citadel on the opposite bank. And on the second or third such sighting, it came to me that when I had swum from the eastern bank, diving from the water stairs and fighting with the tenement children, I had, once or twice, noticed this narrow line of white on the other shore,
so far upstream as to be nearly beyond sight. The botanic garden stood on an island near the bank, enclosed in a building of glass, a thing I had not seen before and did not know could exist. There were no towers or battlements, only the faceted tholis, climbing, until it lost itself against the sky, and its momentary brilliancies were confounded with the faint stars. I asked Adjia if we would have time to see the gardens, and then, before she could reply, told her that I would see them whether there was time or not. The fact was that I had no compunction about arriving late for my death, and was beginning to have difficulty in taking seriously a combat fought with flowers.
"If you wish to spend your last afternoon visiting the gardens, so be it," she said. "I come here myself often. It's free, being maintained by the Autarch, and entertaining, if you're not too squeamish."
We went up steps of glass, paley green. I asked Adjia if the enormous building existed only to provide blooms and fruit. She shook her head, laughing, and motioned toward the wide arch before us.
"On either side of this corridor are chambers, and each chamber is a bioscape. I warn you, though, that because the corridor is shorter than the building itself, the chambers will widen as we go into them more deeply. Some people find that disconcerting." We entered, and in so doing stepped into such silence as must have been in the morning of the world, before the fathers of men first hammered out brazen gongs, built squealing cartwheels, and splashed guile with striding oars. The air was fragrant, damp, and a trifle warmer than it had been outside. The walls to either side of the tessellated floor were also of glass, but so thick that sight could scarcely penetrate them. Leaves and flowers and even soaring trees seen through these walls wavered, as though glimpsed through water. On one broad door I read, "The Garden of Sleep."
"You may enter whichever you like," an old man said, rising from his chair in a corner. "And as many as you like."
Adjia shook her head. "We won't have time for more than one or two."
"Is it your first visit? Newcomers generally enjoy the Garden of Pantomime."
He wore a faded robe that reminded me of something I could not place. I asked if it were the habit of some guild.
"Indeed it is. We are the curators. Have you never met one of our brotherhood previously?"
"Twice, I believe."
"There are only a few of us, but our charge is the most important that society boasts. The preservation of all that is gone. Have you seen the Garden of Antiquities?"
"Not yet," I said.
"You should. If this is your first visit, I would advise you to begin with the Garden of Antiquities. Hundreds and hundreds of extinct plants, including some that have not been seen for tens of millions of years."
Adjia said, "That purple creeper you're so proud of, I met it growing wild on a hillside in Cobbler's Common." The curator shook his head sadly.
"We lost spores, I'm afraid. We know about it. A roof pane broke and they blew away."
The unhappiness quickly left his lined face, draining away as the troubles of simple people do. He smiled.
"It's likely to do well now. All its enemies are as dead as the disorders its leaves cured."
A rumbling made me turn. Two workmen were wheeling a cart through one of the doorways, and I asked what they were doing.
"That's the sand garden. They're rebuilding it. Cactuses and yucca, that kind of thing. I'm afraid there's not much to see there now."
I took Adjia by the hand, saying, "Come on, I'd like to look at the work." She smiled at the curator and gave a half-shrug, but followed docilely enough. Sand there was, but no garden. We stepped into a seemingly unlimited space, dotted with boulders. More stone rose in cliffs behind us, concealing the wall through which we had come. Just beside the doorway spread one large plant, half bush, half vine, with cruel curved thorns. I assumed that it was the last of the old flora, not yet removed. There was no other vegetation, and no sign of the restocking the curator had implied except for the twin tracks of the workman's cart, winding off among the rocks.
"This isn't much," Adjia said. "Why don't you let me take you to the Garden of Delectation?"
The door is open behind us.
Why is it I feel I can't leave this place?
She looked at me sidelong.
"Everyone feels like that in these gardens, sooner or later, though usually not so quickly. It would be better for you if we stepped outside now."
She said something else as well, something I could not catch.
Far off, I seemed to hear surf pounding on the edge of the world. "Wait," I said.
But Adjia drew me out into the corridor again. Our feet carried away as much sand as a child might hold in the palm of one hand.
"We really don't have much time left now," Adjia told me. "Let me show you the Garden of Delectation, then we'll pluck your avern and go."
"It can't be much later than mid-morning."
"It passed noon.
We were more than a watch just in the sand garden." "Now I know you're lying to me." For an instant I saw a flash of anger in her face. Then it was spread over with an unction of philosophical irony, the secretion of her injured self-esteem. I was far stronger than she, and, poor though I was, richer. She told herself now, I felt I could almost hear her voice whispering in her own ear, that by accepting such insults, she mastered me.
"Severian, you argued and argued, and in the end I had to drag you away. The gardens affect people like that. Certain suggestible people. They say the Autarch wants some people to remain in each to accent the reality of the scene, and so his Archimage, Father Anir, has invested them with a conjuration. But since you are so drawn to that one, it's not likely any of the others will affect you so much." "I felt I belonged there," I said, "that I was to meet someone, and that a certain woman was there, nearby but concealed from sight."
We were passing another door on which was written, "The Jungle Garden." When Adjia did not answer me, I said, "You tell me the others won't affect me, so let's go in here."
"If we waste our time with that,
we won't get to the Garden of Delectation at all.
Only for a moment."
Because she was so determined to take me into the garden she had selected, without seeing any of the others, I had grown frightened of what I might find there, or bring with me. The heavy door of the jungle garden swung toward us, bringing a rush of steaming air. Beyond, the light was dim and green. Lianas half obscured the entrance, and a great tree, rotted to punk, had fallen across the path a few strides away. Its trunk still bore a small sign, Caesalpinia sapan.
"The real jungle is dying in the north as the sun cools," Adjia said. "A man I know says it has been dying so for many centuries. Here the old jungle stands preserved as it was when the sun was young. Come in. You wanted to see this place."
I stepped inside. Behind us, the door swung shut and vanished.
Chapter 20 Father Anir's Mirrors. As Adjia had said, the real jungle sickened far to the north. I had never seen them, yet the jungle garden made me feel I had. Even now, as I sit at my writing table in the House Absolute, some distant noise brings back to my ears the screams of the magenta-breasted, sinuous-backed parrot that flapped from tree to tree, watching us with white-rimmed and disapproving eyes. Though this is no doubt because my mind was already turned to that haunted place. Through its screaming, a new sound, a new voice came from some red world, still unconquered by thought.
What is it?
I touched Agia's arm.
A Smilodon. But he's far away, and only wants to frighten the deer, so they'll blunder into his jaws. He'd run from you and your sword much faster than you could run from him.
Her gown had been torn by a branch, exposing one breast. The incident had left her in no good mood.
Where does the path lead? And how can the cat be so far off when all this is only one room of a building we saw from the top of the Adamnian steps?
I've never gone so deeply into this garden.
You were the one who wanted to come.
Answer my questions, I said, and took her by the shoulder.
If this path is like the others, I mean in the other gardens, it runs in a wide loop that will eventually return us to the door by which we came in. There's no reason to be afraid.
The door vanished when I shut it.
Only trickery. Haven't you seen those pictures in which a pietist exhibits a meditating face when you're on one side of the room but stares at you when you cross to the opposite wall? We'll see the door when we approach it from the other direction.
A snake with carnelian eyes came gliding onto the path, lifted a venomous head to look at us, then slipped away. I heard Agia's gasp and said, "Who's afraid now? Will that snake flee you as quickly as you would flee it? Now answer my question about the Smilodon. Is it really far away, and if so, how can that be?"
"I don't know."
"Do you think there are answers to everything here? Is that true in the place you come from?" I recalled the Citadel and the age-old usages of the guilds.
"No," I said.
"There are inexplicable offices and customs in my home, though in these decadent times they are falling out of use. There are towers no one has ever entered to, and lost rooms, and tunnels whose entrances have not been seen."
"Then can't you understand that it's the same way here? When we were at the top of the steps and you looked down and saw these gardens, could you make out the entire building?"
"No," I admitted. "There were pylons and spires in the way, and the corner of the embankment."
"And even so, could you delimit what you saw?"
I shrugged. The glass made it difficult to tell where the edges of the building were.
"Then how can you ask the questions you do? Or if you have to ask them, can't you understand that I don't necessarily have the answers? From the sound of the Smilodon's roar, I knew he was far off. Perhaps he is not here at all. Or perhaps the distance is of time."
"When I looked down on this building, I saw a faceted dome. Now when I look up, I see only the sky between the leaves and vines."
"The surfaces of the facets are large.
It may be that their edges are concealed by the limbs," Agia said. We walked on, wading a trickle of water in which a reptile with evil teeth and a thinned back soaked himself. I unsheathed Terminus Est, fearing he would dart at our feet.
"I grant," I told her, that the trees grow too thickly here to permit me to see far to either side.